Welcome to Book Reporter Talks To, where we host in-depth conversations with authors about the books that we love, coming to you wherever you may be. Welcome to Book Reporter Talks To, where today's guest is Nadia Hashemi, and we're going to be talking about Sparks Like Stars, which is a Book Reporter Betzon selection and a book I really, really loved. I first discovered Nadia's work with The Pearl That Broke Its Shell, and I've learned so much about the people and the culture of Afghanistan through her work, something that continues in Sparks Like Stars. Welcome, Nadia. It's so nice to see you again.
Thank you, and it's so nice to be in conversation with you once again.
So let's start by you telling us about Sparks Like Stars.
So Sparks Like Stars is a story of a 10-year-old girl who is in Afghanistan, in Kabul, in the presidential palace in 1978. And she witnesses and survives a military coup that happened in April of 1978. And so Sparks Like Stars is a story of her surviving, of her living through that trauma, and the life that she manages to forge for herself as she eventually becomes an Afghan American, and then has the past come back to face her.
Yeah, it's just so wonderful because we don't remember that much about Afghanistan in 1978. And what you do is immediately draw us into the splendor of the palace, what was happening for this young girl. She's 10 years old, like when this is all erupting. And it's a very different place than from what we know now. And when your book, you know, draws us right there. So tell us, where did the idea for this book come from?
So, you know, a couple of different things came together to really spark the idea for this book. It was, first of all, book clubs. I have had the pleasure of joining so many book clubs, either in person or, you know, in conversations where we're gathering in libraries or at book festivals, and just talking about the themes of my previous stories. And ultimately, the conversation will circle back to, you know, has it always been this way in Afghanistan? Or what started this, you know, these decades of war? What did it look like before then? And of particular interest, because my parents grew up in late 60s to early 70s, Afghanistan, a very, very different country than what we've been seeing on the news for my lifetime. So that, in combination with coming across this newspaper article about the discovery of the bodies of the people who were assassinated in the presidential palace on that night in April of 1978, because that is a true historical event. So I really wanted to go back in time and explore what used to be in Afghanistan, and then explore specifically the moment in time that really tripped the country over into these, you know, decades of war that we've been witnessing.
Yeah, and it's whenever we think about it, we only think of it as a war-torn country. And we're not realizing that there was a time where there was art and culture and everything. It was a beautiful place to visit, a beautiful place to live. And now we just think about strife and we think about conflict and we think about Taliban. I mean, that's basically what everybody thinks about. So there's a soldier at the beginning who saves Sitara, who's the young 10-year-old girl. She tells her, "Your people are gone, your Kabul is gone." What does he mean by that? What is he talking about there? Because it was such a poignant line of, is her life really as she knows it gone at that moment?
It really is to her. I mean, she loses everything at that time. And there's such an upheaval in power, such a shift in power that it's really, and that's what the coup was to do, completely turn the country upside down and take it in a very different direction. But I think also that line probably came from me witnessing the grief in my family members, in my parents and their generation, that their Kabul is gone. You know, when I went back to Afghanistan in 2003 with my parents, that was their first trip back since they'd left in the early 70s. And there were moments where it almost felt like it was, you know, you could hear it in the air that their Kabul was gone. And my parents were not people who were involved with the coup or in any kind of, you know, leadership roles, but that kind of an event really changes the country and just kind of, you know, rips the rug out from what it was. And that's what she's feeling.
Yeah. And it's because she's had this life that was very privileged. I mean, she grew up as a very privileged child and they had a beautiful library, which we'll get back to in a little bit as well. But it was just this way of life, her whole way of life changed completely. And she's really adrift on what's going on at the same time. But by the same token, she's kind of plucky And she's really trying to figure out who she's going to be and what she's going to be next, because something has got to happen for her and she's not quite sure. You know, she takes many risks as she tries to save herself. Is that something that you can see a young child doing? Because there's so many children there that have been under the guise of war, like their whole lives. And it's all about survival. It's not about just playing in the backyard or whatever. It's what you have to do to survive. And in your research, did you see that that's what people would be doing as well?
I think survival instincts are natural. Maybe not in every single person, right? But there are those of us that we see that just kind of like claw at life a little bit harder. Mm-hmm. And you know, will pull themselves out of those circumstances. So in my mind, this is what she is. I think this is what has been kind of infused into her in the short time that her parents had with her and her upbringing. But then inherently within her, that is her personality. Mm-hmm. But you know, survival instincts, you see them I remember walking through the streets of Kabul and just seeing children who were, you know, working, selling little sticks of gum or little packets of tissues. And they were far too young to be breadwinners, and that's what they were doing. So, I remember seeing a little boy who was actually running a shop, and the way he could engage with customers was just remarkable to me. Right? Wow. So it's amazing what circumstances draw out of us, and what they push us to do.
Yeah. And it's not something that the week before she would have thought she was going to do. It's not, it just became a part of a circumstance. So she's brought to a foreign service officer's home. I don't want to give too much away, but she's brought someplace. And when she gets there, the real thing is they've got to get her out of the country. They've got to get her out of the country because they can't realize that she is still alive. And as they escape, a woman who's traveling with her has a great line that she shares: "When you doubt the person you are, come back to this moment." And she's saying that about some people that had helped them. And there's so many small moments of heroism in this story. In fact, heroism is an underlying theme of who's going to help and who's going to do this. So small things like that add up. Small lines. I was underlining so many passages in this book because there are moments like that. So let's talk a little bit about, you know, really, this is your great moment. You may not know it now.
You know, I think that's just... there are so many opportunities. There are opportunities, not just for, you know, for our own benefit, for our own, you know, getting to that next step, but there are so many opportunities in which we can actually make a huge difference in someone else's life. And I think each of us, if we think back to, you know, what's happened or how many doors have been opened or how many small moments in which we've been saved by a small act, we can think of, I hope that that's what we can put our focus on, especially now with this, the last year that we've had. I mean, there are small ways that we can just, you know, sometimes just picking up the phone and checking in on someone, mm-hmm. Or, you know, making the effort to drop off something to someone who's been homebound for a while. Like, there are just so many ways that you can be a hero, that you can do something heroic. And you may not realize the ramifications of it. You may not realize, you know, the reach that you have. But that is what has happened in her story. It's that moment that, you know, you don't want to give away exactly what's going on.
Yeah.
But I'm hopeful that we see those moments in ourselves more.
Yeah. And when you sit there and you say, well, what have I done? Like, everybody has this moment in life of say, what did I do? And this woman wants to remind them, look back on this moment. This is going to be one of the ones you should be remembering in life of what you did. And sometimes there are little things that we do. Like you say, you pick up a phone and call somebody, or you drop a card in the mail, or you do something. And there are those little acts of kindness. And I think over the last year, because our lives kind of stopped and they slowed down, you sort of started to think about, what can I do to appreciate people more? That's what I've been seeing. And I was thinking of it in that moment as well, as these little tiny things that are done for her make her happy. And there have been these things, there are little tiny things that are really big moments as well. So
they are. I mean, I think, you know, someone once gave me like a notebook that I just thought was a really pretty notebook, and she gave it to me, and it was sort of, you know, not any particular occasion, but mm-hmm. it's been, you know, maybe a couple years now. And I took a picture of it and I just, you know, sent a message. I still have this and I still think of you when I use it. And, you know, that's a moment that she kind of brought something to me that was very special. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just kind of showing that appreciation and showing the, what it does over time is another thing too. And so I think that's what she's, you know, trying to impart upon them, is that you may not recognize this as a real moment. It might just be kind of, you know, something that gets lost in the blur of memory, but it is a real thing.
Yeah, you want to come back and be thinking about that. You know, I gave a lot of thought to the line because it pertains to so much of happening in the world today is people are God's cruelest creatures. They step on the back, smallest backs of others to feel an inch taller. And it's so, so right. And it's all about the power to survive at this point and also what we're doing to each other. And I think that there's a lot that you bring into your writing that makes us think about people as people beyond the story of what's happening on the page here. There's just a lot of thinking that you can do. So when I'm looking at that line, is it all about the power to survive? Are we trying to just survive or we're trying to become better at the same time?
Well, I guess it depends, right? I mean, I think sometimes some of the things that we do are out of the survival instinct. I think sometimes what people are doing, it's out of ambition. Mm-hmm. And that's when it really can become toxic, right? Is when people are not just trying to survive, but they're actually trying to rise above and feel better than, or, mm-hmm. you know, better their station and feel above others. So I think some of these conversations or lines might come out of conversations that I've been having with my kids as I try to manage their, you know, the little like tips that they get into amongst themselves and, you know, the things that they say to each other. Because I think I've said that to them, you know, you don't have to make someone else feel worse in order for you to feel better. But, you know, these are the things that we're not in Sitara's situation, right? We're not in a coup. We're not like, hope not, but you know, we're not in that particular situation, but I think that there are some universalities that we can extract.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And, you know, Afghanistan is so different from 1978 to 2008 when the book is, you know, is set. Was it always going to be during those years? Like, I know 78 would have been the coup, but did you choose like what timing you were going to stop at? And was there a specific reason you did that?
I chose the timing because I knew I wanted to talk about the coup. So I knew I was going to start in 78. And then it really comes because that's when the issue of the bodies and what happened to the coup in the coup historically resurfaces again in 2008. So that was my natural framework, which was nice because that was kind of, okay, here's the skeleton of a timeline. And now I have to start to, you know, insert this little girl into this world, into these historical happenings and develop a journey for her.
Yeah, and what did she do along the way? What ends up happening? You know, she's looking for closure and it can only happen when she finds her family being buried properly. It's the thing that she really tears her apart, the thing that keeps her up at night. Have you heard that from people that have lost people in war or in the country or whatever? It's that moment of not having the closure and not knowing exactly what happened. I mean, she saw things that night, but then what happened after there? And her mind starts playing tricks on her of like, what did I really see? What really happened?
Yeah, I think, unfortunately, there are many people in Afghanistan, especially of that generation where there was a lot of, you know, what happened to the political dissenters, that so many were jailed, so many disappeared and were presumably killed. I mean, some were known about. And I know a few people who were of that generation, of that time. And, you know, we don't really sit down to talk about it very much mm-hmm. because I think there is a lot of pain and there is a lot of trauma with the not knowing, with the wondering mm-hmm. and, you know, possibly even just imagining what could have happened and how did things go down. So, So I hopefully did a bit of justice to what kind of trauma that is, which I, you know, thankfully personally, I've never experienced, but it's just something that's pretty heartbreaking to even start to imagine.
Yeah. I feel like there's like an open wound on her and the wound is never going to be completely healed. It may scab over, but it's not going to be completely healed until she knows what happened to her family and where she can put them to rest. It's I just feel like it's an open thing. And there are parallels here to the Romanovs. Was that there from the start or was that something that you layered in later on?
It was there from early on. You know, I went through a couple of, you know, trying to figure out how am I going to tell this story? It's almost, you know, when you've got an idea for a story, you can kind of see the story, but then I kind of liken it to, you know, where do you put the cameras mm-hmm. and from what perspective do you then tell the story? You know, do you do it in the first person? Do you do it in the third person? How do you position yourself as the narrator? And so at some point in figuring out, you know, the early drafts, when I was talking to someone about the story, they brought up the Romanovs and I hadn't even made the connection. It's like my previous book, someone was like, oh, this is like a Cinderella story. And I had never thought of Cinderella. I guess in my mind, they're so different, you know, these characters. But then I started digging into the Romanov story, and I kind of fell into this huge rabbit hole. And I would imagine that for someone who had survived this kind of an event, wouldn't they be fascinated, even if it was like almost like a dark fascination, but with anybody else who had been through anything similar, especially if no one around you has had anything close happen to them in their lives. Mm-hmm. So wouldn't you look for direction from somewhere?
And there's the history. There's the history. Where's Anastasia? What ended up happening to her? This is our real life Anastasia right now. And that's where she's seeing herself. What was your research process like? You found this New York Times article. Did you know right away you wanted to write something from the Times piece and start researching? Or was that something that you found at a time where you were just like supposed to be doing other things?
I think I was supposed to be doing other things. I'm usually supposed to be doing other things, but that's how I justify my wandering, is thinking, you know, it might be research for a book. You just never know it. And that truly is what happens. You just never know what you're going to stumble upon and where you're going to use it. This is my desk where I do some of my work. So I can kind of swing around and show you, like, this is my little, you know, board of things. And so if I find interesting things, I just kind of, you know, pin them to my board, or if it's a clipping, I'll put it into, sometimes I kind of like clip them into a notebook, and I might return to it when I can figure out, you know, what I'm going to do with it. I think I sat on that article for a bit of time until I could sit down and really start to flesh out a story, but I knew I wanted to tell a story about that time. I knew I wanted to tell the story of, you know, what really happened to Afghanistan and what forces were responsible for creating such instability and this tug of war in the country. Now, the actual research for it, I'm going to pull out my binder. So this is my Sparks Like Stars binder, right? So I get to, you know, play with all my stationery goods when I do this research. And so for different parts of it, I use different things. Like, for example, for the Foreign Service officer, I went through, there's a website called ADST.org. It's the American Diplomatic, the Association for Diplomatic Studies and Trainings or something like that. But it's an amazing resource where they've interviewed Foreign Service officers over the years stationed in different times and different places. And so I'm digging through reading what the Americans who were stationed in Kabul in 1978 during the coup were saying. And then I, you know, did my little inspector and hunting around and found one of the Foreign Service officers, a lovely woman, who then became my primary resource for that period of time. So I interviewed her and, you know, had some back and forth and just asked her questions. And so when you read things in the story about, for example, like the musical Oklahoma, that's real, right? So they were really putting on a performance of the musical Oklahoma. And just hearing that was, to me, like, who would imagine Americans putting on a musical, like the most American musical of all, in Kabul, right? It's really hard to imagine when we think of Kabul today. And so those were the things that stuck out to me. The archaeology pieces, I mean, there are like National Geographic books and then just a lot of newspaper articles and different things online that are available, which, you know, the internet makes research so much easier and accessible.
In a year when you can travel like now, too. The only place people are traveling is the internet, you know?
So it's it's amazing what we've been able to do. And so those are the different pieces that I would put together in combination with, you know, some of the things that family members who were living in Kabul at that time, just what the mood felt like in the country, that sense of, you know, don't say things that where people can hear you because you just don't know who thinks what and who you can trust and who you can't trust. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, one of the parts that was really fun was the overlanders, these hippies who were traveling through the country. And oh my gosh, like the pictures that are available online, I could just get lost staring at them. And the guidebook, the guidebook that's mentioned in the story is based on an actual guidebook that I read, which is fascinating, the way people are like telling each other where to get high, where not to get high,
like, what not to do when you're there. Yeah.
So the research for this was just way too much fun.
Yeah, it sounds like it. It sounds like, but so then you have everything color coded in the book, like different pieces of like Foreign Service is green. The hippies are.
I do. I have my little like organizer tabs, right? I mean, I was a good student in school, so. Wow. I was taught well how to break down the research.
And As you were, okay, so after you finished writing the book, okay, you finished your first draft or whatever, do you go back through there to see, oh, there's something else I should have included? Or where do you go with the story? Like, okay, you've got your first draft done, you've put together that. What's next? Do you go back and try filling in pieces? Do you ever leave lines to say, add later?
I do, but by the time I say that the draft is done, then I can't have any of those gaps, really. Although I will say for Sparks Like Stars, you know, if I remember correctly, I hadn't written the last chapter. I just couldn't do the last chapter or two. And I really wanted it to get, before I send it to my editor, I want to get it in its most possibly finished form so that I'm not, you know, totally embarrassed by what I'm delivering. But I really tried to get it, and I just couldn't get myself to write like the last chapter or two. I can't remember. So I sent it off to her, and then we started, you know, kind of working through the mechanics of like, okay, so when will this come out, and what are we going to do with it? And then what kind of work will need to go into it. And then she always sends it back with lots of, you know, really great feedback. And it's amazing how many times we can go back and forth and just really improve things. Mm-hmm. And move the story toward its like final and, you know, intended form. And then when she sent it back to me, that's when I finally wrote the last couple of chapters. But usually I try to get it all done. I will go back and flip through the research bits just to make sure. And I usually keep like a file on my computer of like things to add back in, and then make sure that I've found places to plug them back in, because otherwise it gets lost. And then I don't want to be sitting here with you and realizing when I look over at my board that there was like a really cool fact that I didn't get into the story.
There's some big factoid that, oh, wow, that would have just made that chapter. But, you know, I also like when you go back and you look and you find something that can really pull it together and say, wait a second, if I just put that in now and I move this around. I mean, even when I'm writing interview questions, I've got an order and then I start switching it all around so that actually we flow and we're not talking about the end of the book at the beginning or, yeah. You know, different parts or whatever.
Within the process, that's very organic. And somehow, you know, something in chapter 27 really makes something in chapter second, almost the second chapter, like feel wise and smart. Like, oh, you knew you were going to do that in chapter one. No, I didn't know what I was doing. But sometimes these things kind of end up working themselves out.
It was in your brain. It was in the back of your brain, you know? Well, there's a reporter, we're not going to give away too many details. His name is Clay. And he starts talking about the politics of Afghanistan with the Foreign Service officer. And her name is Antonia. And we see people like fighting over this land and what they can do best for it. And we're going back and forth. And it's, was it the Russians? Was it the Americans? Was it this? Was that? Whose hunger for trying to save things was doing what to the country? And it was a very interesting go back and forth, because we always think of it from the American point of view. Like, we are right, this is what happened, but we don't often look at the full story. I mean, even when you're studying history in school, you know, battles, this, that, but you never see what was England actually thinking about at this time. It's only from our point of view. And I found it was so interesting. Where did that come into your storytelling?
So, I mean, I grew up in the 80s and, you know, the era of like Reagan, Cold War was into Hollywood even. And that was what the story was. Early on, it was, you know, the United States is helping the freedom fighters, right? We're calling them like freedom fighters. And they were, I mean, they were fighting for freedom from the Russian invaders. But there wasn't a lot of conversation about why had Russia invaded and how was the U.S. getting military weapons over to them, and why was it so secret until the Stinger missiles went over? And just, you know, there's a lot of on the ground stuff happening that wasn't discussed, because it seemed like it was the Russian invasion that really toppled Afghanistan over into war. But, you know, when you go back and you take a look, a closer look, there was a lot happening before then. So I realized in my own education, you know, there's an Oliver Stone documentary, like series that was, oh my God, I'm blanking on the name of it, like the Real American History or something like that. And he just provides such an eye-opening view of what the United States' role has been in Vietnam and Korea, I mean, in all these different countries. And it's just not as clean cut as we would like it to be. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes I think intentions might be good. Sometimes they might be kind of murky, and there is a real price to pay for that. So I wanted to at least bring that up. I wanted to just bring some awareness because Afghanistan is such a big issue for the United States right now. And for our decisions going forward, it would just be nice to have an understanding of where the involvement between the United States and Afghanistan started in order to understand, you know, what responsibilities or what kind of outcomes should we be expecting on the other side of this.
Yeah, and it could be, oh, we have 1,000 troops still there. What does that really mean? Let's talk about what happened back at the beginning. You know, there's a book called The Photographer. It's Into War-Torn Afghanistan with Doctors Without Borders. It's a nonfiction graphic novel that I read years ago. And one of the creators was at this event. And it's an event my son and I still talk about. And they were boots on the ground traveling through Afghanistan in these war-torn areas, what it was like, you know, being there. And at the same time, one of the doctors actually called people back in the United States and said, there's a guy you're giving arms to. His name is Osama bin Laden. You need to stop. He is not on our side. There is something that's going to happen. I've seen his eyes and it's not good. And I got chills when I was at this event when they were relaying the story because the doctors were there in a very different role. They were just there to help. They were just here to cure. But the cues that they were picking up on as they were up in the mountains and at they were seeing what's going on, and they said, we're seeing something with this guy and you really need to pay attention. And it was so crazy to hear later on, you know, after 9/11 and after what ended up happening, that they were actually pretenders of what was going on. And they said, we're not sure where we're fighting the right battle right now. We're not sure what we're doing. And it was, I just found it was like, you know, so interesting because we only hear one narrative and we only accept one narrative usually.
Yeah, no, I'll have to check that one out. I haven't come across that one yet, but it sounds amazing. I think, again, the United States has a really long history of friends turning into enemies and enemies turning back into friends. It just depends on, you know, what we're doing at the time, which is a really dangerous kind of policy to have.
So now you were living, okay, you were born here. You didn't go back until, what was it, 2003. Okay. So what was it like for you, like right after 9/11? Because all of a sudden, you know, you were born here, your parents have been here for a really long time. What ends up happening for you in those moments?
So, you know, for me, I was in New York City. I was in Brooklyn. So 9/11 was, you know, obviously a moment that everybody remembers where they were at that time. I was in a first year medical lecture hall and just remember this kind of like buzz going through the lecture hall and not knowing what's happening, what's going on, the professor at the front of the room not knowing what was happening. And then people just started like leaving the room, the lecture hall. We all kind of like filtered into the lobby of the building and then starting to get, you know, pieces of information. And my cousin was working at the time at World Financial Center. So she was right next door. So, you know, I'm on the phone, everybody around me is on the phone, scrambling, trying to figure out, you know, what's going on across the river. And then just in the immediate time after that, there was sort of, I think, a knee jerk reaction in the country, which was a surprise for me and for a lot of people who, like me, had been fairly anonymous until that time. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I do remember like just small events, like people shouting things at me and a couple of my friends as we were walking home, you know, across the street. My parents had a cute little deli. We'd been in that town for just decades. We knew everybody in town. And in the weeks after, you know, somebody at some point threw a rock or something and broke the windows of the store. But, you know, on the flip side, then the town came together, the mayor came and people kind of contributed some, you know, small bills and money and they helped, you know, they put the window back together. So I think, you know, we just witnessed that kind of like knee-jerk reaction. And then there were obviously some rumblings ongoing where there was just a lot of miscommunication, a lot of misunderstanding, a lot of not knowing who we are, where do your allegiances lie, and so many assumptions that just created more space between us instead of helping us to sit down and talk about, you know, what actually happened and why and how do we all kind of, you know, work our way through this, because it was an egregious, I mean, horrific event. And I think we all felt it.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was interesting. I had a guy working for me at the time. He was in our design area and his name was Nazimal. I remember his last name right now. And he was supposed to go to Boston that weekend and he was supposed to fly like after we could start flying again. And he goes, no, I'm going to drive. He says, I will not be able to get on a plane. And I had not really, it personalized what people were going through to me very, very much, because I knew him. I knew he was this terrific person. And he goes, you just don't understand. Right now I'm a marked guy. And he says, it's like, you know, everybody, I feel like as I'm going down the street, everybody is looking at me. And when we hear so much today about, you know, prejudice and how people feel and whatever, it's been going on for a very long, long time. And you start to see people as people when you work with them or you're in different places with them or whatever. And it's not just, oh, he's such and such. We don't label people like quite the same way. It's a very, very interesting moment for me. I remember that. And I was like, well, why aren't you going to fly? Why are you going to drive? You know, why are you going to do that?
True. And so, I think sometimes we probably had the luxury of taking it a bit lightly in my family, because we didn't have some of the, you know, the more serious assumptions. But I remember we went to Vegas, me, my brother, my cousin, and my two cousins. So it was, you know, two girls and two guys. And I remember us getting on the plane, and us and my brother and my cousin were both guys. It took them a lot longer to get through at the airport. And we were kind of teasing them about it, that we could get through and yet they couldn't, right? But, you know, that's a real thing. And mm-hmm. some people who just really couldn't even fly at all, instead of just kind of being held back and being at the end of the line and having to go through pat downs and stuff like that. I mean, it's a real difference.
It's a real difference of what ends up happening. Well, speaking of a difference, you're a pediatrician. You studied medicine, became a pediatrician. In your book, the protagonist is an oncologist. And why that change in her being that kind of a doctor?
So she is definitely not me. And I wanted to make sure that she's not me. Oncology is a field that I was really drawn to and considered becoming a pediatric oncologist. But, you know, my path took a different turn. But again, this is somebody who is not supposed to be me. She's not supposed to, she doesn't have the experiences that I have. So in, you know, the creation of her personality, of her judgment, of her ambition, she is a completely, entirely different entity. And I want to make sure that she is as removed from me as possible, but still, you know, having to be able to insert her at times that really define the Afghan-American experience. And that was a period of time, I think, that was really important in the Afghan-American experience was, you know, our lives are sort of like the pre-9/11 and the post-9/11 in America in general. And then for the Afghan-Americans as well, it's just, there was definitely a shift in what the experience was like. So I wanted her to be there at that moment because it was such a pivotal moment and because I could actually speak about it, but to do it in a different way.
Yeah, just change your discipline a little bit. It's like change your discipline. I also thought that treating children would have been too hard for her after what she had been through. That was my, well, you know, one thought on it as well. So besides that one trip back to Afghanistan, have you been back again?
No, I haven't. You know, that was actually a really amazing time to be able to go back. It was sort of, you know, this like honeymoon period. Everything was really nice. And then things were okay for a while after that. The situation more recently has really become very tricky and very dangerous. So it's very hard at this point now. And for the past few years, it's been hard with four kids to like travel anywhere, but it's hard to imagine, you know, kind of picking up and going there. We've had people we know who've gone back and they've had a great time. They've been able to do lots of stuff. I actually have one of my cousins just went back and visited some family and she's back as well. But for me, it's just been harder to kind of make that leap. And my husband was born and raised in Afghanistan, left during the years of war. So for him too, he has a harder time wrapping his head around, you know, the idea of going back, mm-hmm. or, you know, when we don't really have much family there or much to connect with other than the country itself.
Let's go back, just go to the place. Mm-hmm. You know, there's something you bring up there. There are two words that are very close in spelling and very different in meaning. Shahid is witness. Shahid with E-E-D is martyr. And Sitara, this young girl, sees the similarity between the two, witness and martyr, what you see and, you know, how you feel. Do you speak Afghan at all?
I speak Dari, yeah. So there are two big languages in Afghanistan. So Dari, which is sometimes called Farsi, it's a dialect of Farsi. And then there's the Pashto. So in my family, we speak Dari. And you know, there's sometimes there are just words that I do it in English too, where you just kind of like start thinking about a word and noticing it in a different way. And when I'm thinking about her experiences and the way she would look at words, that was one that just stuck out to me, that, you know, why are these words so similar? What is the connection here?
Yeah, what's the connection with it? Okay, now do your children speak the language as well?
They understand like 10 words. But what
That's
they
good.
do understand is that when mommy and daddy are speaking in daddy, then they better watch out because something's going on. And so their little like antennae pop up and they come up, "What are you guys talking about? Did you say I think I heard my name. Was it his name or her name?" Or like, so there's a lot of anxiety around it. And we always tell them, well, if you want to know what we're talking about, then you have to learn the language. But
I was thinking of that because when I was young, my parents would speak Italian like they did, buddy, and we just sit there and go, "Wait, what are they talking about?" And Kia Dude was the children. like, "Wait a second, we're in that sentence, you know? Like, it's what's going on." It's
yeah.
very funny because I had this thought of like what your children must be like. It's like they hear this, they're like, "Wait a second, what's going on?"
Yeah.
English, Pierre, English.
But they like today they've been starting to play a lot of card games with my parents. So all the like the card games that Afghans play. So they may not speak the language, but my daughter will play Afghan. She can play an Afghan song really beautifully on her viola. And then my two sons are like playing the Afghan card game. So even without the language, there's a lot of the culture and the experience. They have those bridges somehow.
Yeah, I absolutely love that. So what's the presidential palace like today? Has it been, is it, in its all its glory? Is it beautiful again?
Well, I haven't had the pleasure of walking through it, but the structure is the same from what we can see. I think they've been some restorations of different parts of it because the pictures that I've seen online, it looks like it's been wonderfully done on the inside.
Right.
So, and if you, I mean, going into Kabul, even when I went in 2003, you could see there was a lot of reconstruction, and they're not just kind of like patching things up. They were kind of, gutting and rebuilding. So it was a mix, and they've got, shopping malls that are coming up, these big stores that are, developing. So it's a very different city, I think, than what people would imagine.
Right. How have they been hit by the pandemic? Has it been there as well? Like, is there an, is there, so wait a second. So right now we have the vaccine, like the four vaccines, then it, is it easy for them to get those, or is that one of the countries that's going to be one of the last, like, I mean, not use it up, but, as a, what you call it, you're not going to have to share this for me, like from a government point of view, but what are you seeing?
So I can't speak to exactly how easily the government's been able to acquire. I know that India made a gift of a bunch of vaccines to Afghanistan. So at least some came from that from that angle. And the government's probably purchased some through whatever mechanisms that they are able to. When I've heard the president speak about the pandemic in Afghanistan, it did hit them, that a lot of we had extended family members, my husband's side, who had gotten sick. Actually, I think he lost two family members, extended family members to COVID. Overall, though, I think that Afghanistan has a really, really young population. Demographics are skewed very, very young because of the years of war, because of, life expectancy and so many things. So overall, I think their mortality rates weren't as bad as one would expect just because people were younger. And they did have, I saw pictures of people and, in protective gear, checking temperatures in some places, sanitizing, when they were delivering things to different households. What it also has done, though, is exacerbated the existing problems of poverty, of inequalities, the same thing that it has done over here. So families where, you've got somebody who's like the primary breadwinner, and now you've got somebody who's out with COVID. They're living in close quarters. You've got big families living in small quarters. And so all of a sudden you've got a family of, maybe seven people who are sick and they can't work. And, how are they going to feed and feed themselves? And so just a lot of exacerbation of, I guess, previously existing problems.
Previous existing conditions. What I was thinking of too is with war there, are there a lot of single women of a certain age? Like I remember it, reading after World War I and World War II, there were so many women that there would not be enough men for them to marry. Is that same thing happened there, that there's a gap in like whole groups of age groups?
That's a good question. I don't know the statistics well enough to say if there are. I think the gap might be kind of closing if it is, because you're not really seeing as much just, pure like war there as you were before. You're now seeing these kind of, attacks in different places where, you know, either civilians are being attacked, or lately it's even been, you know, strategic targeting of women who are of, you know, certain positions like journalists and judges and things like that. So, so if there probably were more wider gaps in that gender breakdown, but I would imagine that they're kind of closing in now.
Closing in. So there seems to be so many historic sites, historical treasures, antiquities, a real history of the place. And how much has been lost to war? I mean, you know that when war happens, people hide things, number one. But number two, there are things that are stolen. They're brought to other countries. So has a lot of the history been either destroyed by violence or brought to other places?
It has. I mean, I think one of the best examples are like the Buddhas of Bamyan that we all heard about around the world. I mean, those huge towering Buddhas that have been carved into the mountain that were destroyed by the Taliban purposefully. I mean, that's like a historic site. But then down to just smaller pieces, like the ones that are kind of talked about in this book, mm-hmm. that just end up on the black market, end up in, you know, some vault somewhere, and who knows, and maybe they're going to, people are going to lose track of them. So there's a lot of history, I think, that is lost. And then what I really wanted to explore through that was the question of, you know, to whom do these historic pieces actually belong once they have left the country? Should they be repatriated? Is it wrong to have smuggled them out of the country and save them from being lost or damaged in years of conflict? And then, you know, is there a time where they actually just should be returned to that country where they came from? And acknowledged, because you do have pieces from certain countries of conflict that are right now in, you know, museums around the world. Mm-hmm. And that is a question that is being, you know, the ethics of museums is a really interesting question to me.
Yeah. And it's interesting because there is something that happens in the book for those who haven't read yet, that there's something that she then wants to go replace because she doesn't think it should be hers. She doesn't think that she should be holding on to it. And yet it's something that matters a lot to her as well. So it's that push-pull kind of a thing of it's a talisman in a lot of ways, but by the same token, it's not something she knows she owns. And they gave me a lot of thinking. You've also talked about decades of fighting have led to something called Afghan war carpets. And I actually went and looked up pictures of these, of carpets that actually depict, like, this is what happened in this battle. This is what happened in this war with airplanes or whatever. Did you come across those in your research, or did you know about them already?
I knew about them, but sometimes you just see things, like you just kind of wake up to it, right? I mean, I've seen the war carpets, I've seen them, but sometimes you just have a moment where you're like, wait, that's weird, isn't it? Isn't it weird that we make carpets about war? Afghans make such beautiful carpets, right? The carpets are in so many different places. Sometimes you'll spot them in like movies when I'm like, that's an Afghan carpet right there, you know? But then a war carpet, why would you actually like weave that? But I guess, you know, there's something about weaving a story into the tapestry kind of, you know, but there's also, I think, a market for these pieces. Mm-hmm. And I remember speaking to someone once who was like, oh yeah, I have a great, you know, war carpet that I picked up when I was traveling through Pakistan or something. And I'm like, it's great.
Great war carpet. know? What room do you have that in?
Sometimes these pieces are kind of novelties, but you know, that novelty, okay, you've depicted on this a tank and missiles flying. And what did that tank do? What was the intention of that? I wanted a moment of awareness of what we sometimes glorify, you know, mm-hmm. Is there a risk in doing that?
Mm-hmm. Well, you think about it, soldiers walk outside the palace with guns, either protecting or later on there's a coup. So there's these signs of, this is a symbol of what? Is it a symbol of protection or is it a symbol of war? And they go back and forth both ways. So when you're seeing and you're watching a soldier walking outside a building, are they protecting that building or are they part of the, you know, violence that's happening in the area? And I found that just so interesting to just think about, because there were people guarding them before and then all of a sudden there's this uprising and it's like, wait a second, who's doing what? Somebody was protecting me with that same gun this whole time. You know, they're there the same way.
But I think that's the questions that we have about around us, like are these things that we assume are here to protect us, can they flip on us at any given moment?
Yeah, what can happen at any time? You know, Sitara is hiding so much about her past, and she does see books connecting her to her parents. And at the start of the book, she's in the palace library, which just sounds absolutely beautiful. And at one point, she has a great line about seeing women in a book club. She said that they rarely meet to talk about their own, they beat to talk about their own lives, not the book. This is when she's older. And that's something she doesn't want to share. So she doesn't think she can be in a book club. So I just found that to be so fascinating because it's true. You start talking about the book and then all of a sudden it's like, well, this is what happened with, and she doesn't want that part of her life to be known. So do you see that a lot when you're talking to book clubs?
I do. I think that's what we all do with stories, you know, to different extent, depending on the story, right? I mean, I've never been in a Hunger Games kind of situation to relate to, but I think that certain stories might draw certain reactions out of us, and we relate it to, you know, relationships in our lives, you know, the dynamics that we've witnessed or that we've experienced ourselves. And I love that about book clubs. I love how personal people can get in mm-hmm. them. And what kinds of powerful connections people can actually develop with stories, which is, it's just really amazing, right? I mean, they're all fictional characters and just words on a page. And yet there's an actual like emotional connection to them. I can see it in some of the messages that people send me, which are just amazing. I'm just trying to imagine. So what I do with these characters is just imagine, you know, I test them out in different situations where I've been and I know how I react. I see a book club and I'm like, oh, how cool, you know, people coming together. But how would she react?
Right.
And that's really what the story is about is, you know, how does this individual react and respond to these experiences and these stimulations?
And to think about it, she doesn't even own her name. We're not going to tell anymore, but she just doesn't even own the name that she's using at this point. So if anybody says anything to her about, well, what about this? How can she react? What does she remember about kindergarten? What does she remember? She'd have to reveal too much about what she's gone through in her life. And it's something that she doesn't really want to share with very many people. It's something that she really wants to keep hidden. So if people do want to join your book, do have their book club speak with you, can they reach out to you on your website or what can they do?
Sure. Yeah. On my website, I tend to be pretty easy to find. So my website.
That's good.
Or off of one of the social media platforms. I'm on Facebook and Instagram. And then, you know, just the email that comes to me is NadiaHashimiBooks@gmail.com, but that's easily found on my website.
Well, and also I'm going to say to people, if you do want to speak with her, tell her what time your group meets and tell her what time zone that's in, because that becomes a very big thing during the pandemic, especially everybody thinks the time zone is theirs and it's not. So I think that, you know, remember she's in the Eastern time zone. Think about that when you're planning your meeting, you know, 10 o'clock meeting at night, not going
to
work.
I've learned over the years to always ask people, sure, 3 o'clock is good, but what time zone are you in?
Well, and it's really funny because we do a lot of virtual events and we'll see all of a sudden somebody will sign onto our Zoom room like 2 hours later. And we're like, okay, Midwest, West yep. Coast is coming up in an hour. We'll see what's going on. So, exactly. You know, I love the celebration of spring called, is it Nowruz? That yep. Nowruz. Does your family celebrate that? I can't figure out which culture celebrate it. And I saw a number of friends posting pictures on social media the other day, and it just looks like it's such a beautiful celebration. So can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, yeah. Nowruz is my favorite celebration because it's spring and there's so many holidays from different cultures and faiths that happen around this time. I think there's something really special about, you know, the welcoming of spring. So it's on the first day of spring. That's Nowruz, now meaning new, and Ruz meaning day. So it's new day, but really means new year. And so, you know, some of the traditions are where we color eggs and then we have little like egg fights to see whose shell is the hardest. And my mom makes the traditional like drink, or I don't even know if you call it a drink or a dessert or what it is, but it is like the raisins and nuts and dried fruits that are just soaked in this water. So it sweetens it. And then, you know, just peeled walnuts and almonds and, like I said, dates and a couple other dried fruits that I don't know the names of in English, but but it's amazing. And yet we can only have it once a year because peeling all those walnuts is a real like pain. So there's that. And then we set up a table called the Haftin, and the Haftin, it has seven things on it that start with the letter S. Which in daddies start with the letter S. And so there is like garlic and apple, some grass seeds that we plant, and then that grows. So you get a little like square of grass kind of growing. And they all have different significances like health, good luck, good fortune, you know, family together and all that kind of stuff. And then there's certain foods that we eat on that day, like rice and spinach, and people do a lot of fish. So it's just a very like fresh, refreshing, you know, rejuvenating holiday.
I've always wanted to be invited to somebody's celebration because I find it fascinating when people put the pictures up every year, and it's a real, the way they lay them out, you know that there's been real thought behind what everybody's done, and it's culturally. I just find other cultures fascinating. And I think the one thing about social media I really love is getting to see how people celebrate in different cultures, whether it's Passover, Easter, or Nowruz. And it's like, and just to see what they do, because we think of people as, oh, we're all Americans, or all we're all this, but to see traditions that have infused cultures, I find to be so interesting.
Yeah, that's what I love. And I love how, you know, they can kind of be connected. Like you see, I look at the decorations for Easter and I can kind of grab some of them and use them for Nowruz because they fit in really well, right? Or that some people are using for Passover, some of the colors are just, you know, there's something about spring that wants us to celebrate it, right? Its arrival. And so, you know, no matter who you are or where you are, our faiths and our cultures are driving us in that direction.
See, but I don't think there's an Nowruz aisle at Michael's, at the, you know, the store where you buy all these, like, everything Easter eggs and plastic and Easter baskets and everything like that in the grass. And I'm like, wait a second, I've never seen the aisle that has all these things in it. There's got to be a reason, you know? At one point towards the end of the book, I read a line, "Sparks rain from my size like stars." Was "Sparks Like Stars" always the title? Was this always what you knew going in?
No, I'm horrible at titles. I cannot come up with them. And so, you know, when I'm writing this book, it's going to, on my laptop, it'll be my work in progress and it'll be like the book, right? And that's just what it's called. Or Sitara's story. That's it. Because at this point I've learned that I struggle with titles for some reason. But I'm very, very fortunate that my agent, Helen Heller, is amazing with titles. And so she's been really great at, you know, she knows the stories, and then she'll flip through and she knows that I'm, you know, I usually incorporate some Sufi poetry or some kind of poetry into the story. So she's been able to kind of go and find lines of poetry that just fit. So, you know, "The Pearl That Broke Its Shell," she found that one. "When the Moon Is Low," that was her find as well. I think she did "House Without Windows" too. The only one of my books that I have titled, she even titled the children's book, "One Half from the East." She found that title, which I thought was just so perfect. And again, these all come from poetry. The only book that I've titled so far is "The Sky at Our Feet," but that's it. So "Sparks Like Stars," my other poems, the adult ones, the adult titles, I have pulled, I've wanted to pull some kind of, you know, poetry, and they've all come from like Hafiz or Rumi and, you know, long dead poets who are remarkable and widely read, but different. For this one, I knew that I wanted an Afghan woman's poetry to be incorporated into the story. It was just for me, like, this is a time where I really wanted to center a woman's voice. And I hadn't really told Helen that. And I was, you know, going through books and going through whatever I could find. And she called me one day and she said, you know, I'm here with Rachel Kahn is my editor. She said, we're here together and we've got a proposal for you on a title, "Sparks Like Stars." And I was like, oh, I like that. And then she showed me, you know, the poem, and the poem comes from an Afghan woman, a poet named Nadia Anjuman. And it was just like, okay, you knew what I wanted. And she,
I love Helen. I love Helen. I love the way her eye just like goes to something. She's very like, okay, this is what I think we should do. And she's very thoughtful. And then she'll just give the answer. And it's the answer, because she's
the answer. Yeah.
Heard the whole room. And then she said, this is what to do.
Yeah. I've learned that that's when she points you in a direction, you just go in that direction and you'll be fine.
Yeah. Yeah. And if she says, this is really good, this is done, it's done. Like, it's really done. It doesn't need any more. The cover is so good. Was this the first try on the cover?
It was, yeah. And this is the same designer who has done the my other covers. And then this one kind of, you know, again, it appeared in my inbox of, here, Nadia, here's a draft of the cover design. And I opened it and I'm like, draft? This is not a draft. This is the final, you know?
This is it.
So, and the response, you know, we were talking about Instagram. Instagram has really shown a lot of love for this cover design. Mm-hmm. It's just very pretty. So it will look great on anyone's bookshelf, if I may.
Yes, that's exactly. And I just have an advanced reading copy, and it still looks beautiful. Mozan Mozan Marno does a great job of narrating the audiobook. Did you have a hand in selecting her?
I did make the suggestion to my editor, and then I didn't know, you know, she said, well, let me look into it. And then I didn't really ask about it. I try not to be, you know, a micromanager too involved in anything. But I remember someone either tweeting or posting something, and they said, oh, I listened to Mejean Marno narrate this. And I was like, oh, okay. So we that ended up working out. But I think, you know, just having heard her voice in narrating other books, I thought she would be a good fit for telling this particular story.
Well, she did. And how's the pronunciation name? Mejean?
Mejean Marno.
Mejean Marno. Okay. It's always interesting with audiobook narrators. Very few have the phonetic spelling of their names on their websites. Yet it, and very few times when you listen to a clip or whatever, do they actually say their name. So as a result, my producer Austin and I have spent more time trying to get the pronunciation of the narrator correct. And I actually said to somebody at the Audio Publishers Association, could you just do a website where you have the phonetic, they all just submit what is phonetically written. And they're like, really? It's that hard to figure this out? And I said, you know these people. I don't know these people. I've never spoken to them. And there's sometimes they'll even just put them up and they'll have apostrophes like over their name where, you know, epaulets of what, you know, what you should be doing. I'm not going to get that completely correct. I mean, it's just, could you just have a completely phonetically spell there? So it becomes very, very funny for me.
I pronounced her correctly. That's how we would say it. And, you know, I think she's of Iranian descent. So there's a bit of a difference in our pronunciations, but that's how I would assume that it's pronounced.
Mejean. Mejean. Okay. Are you working on something new now?
I am. I'm working on what will be hopefully my first young adult book.
Wow. Something completely different.
Something completely different. Still don't have enough of it done to be able to talk about it. Maybe 2/3 of it done. So hoping to be able to get that finished and then work on something after that. But this has been a heck of a year for writing because I have, you know, 4 kids who are at home and they're basically all elementary school level.
So that's all that range. Oh my gosh. Oh my, yeah, I can't even picture.
A 4th grade, a 1st grade. And then my youngest is going to be going to kindergarten this year. So we've got, you know, not enough Wi-Fi for anything. And then, but we have like beyond the necessary resources. It's just that, you know, no matter what you have, it's been a tricky year. So just trying to kind of get them through and talk them through what it takes to be a bit more resilient, the lessons we can learn from this, to teach myself some lessons of, you know, how critical is it to get all your homework assignments in when it's so crazy what we have to do, learning how to like check all these different school websites for I mean it's been wild.
So funny, so many authors that I've tuned in, their child's name is their name on Zoom because their child was in school that morning, and somebody said the other day, I was like looking at the name, she turned around and she said, oh, she's 4, let me just change the name. And it's, she says, that was like school this morning. And it's really interesting about what people have had to do. And the idea, I thought the other day about the concept of homework, it's all home, it's like all home. Do we need to do anything in the evening? We've just sat there all day long doing these things. So
yeah, it's crazy. I mean, sometimes you just have to laugh. Like my kids have gym class at home, right? So I'm over here working, and then I look over and my daughter is like, you know, throwing rolled up socks into the air and catching them. Like, what are you doing? She's like, I'm in gym class.
This is very important, Mom. I'm in gym. We saw a bunch of kids riding their bikes one day, and I said, it must be gym. They must have said, leave your house. Just get out of your house. Give your parents 20 minutes and go ride your bike or something and come back and report on what you did. But, you know, I was thinking about it. If you were a little kindergartner and you left school, let's say last March, like March was the last time you were in school, you may not go back till 2nd grade, and you may not have had any 1st grade in any kind of a classroom at all. And I think that the ramifications of what this is going to be, I think we have, okay, we understand what it's like to have everybody home, but everybody can assimilate it to going back and sitting in a chair at a desk all day and paying attention is going to be another big landmine for us all to go through in the fall. Anybody with young children, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I think, you know, and that's one thing that I think that the immigrant population has really kind of said, they've taken this in stride, right? Because so many people who come here as immigrants, they have, or as refugees, They've been through a lot. And so this is, you know, like, okay, we understand how to deal with major upheavals in our life structure. And that's kind of the grounding I'm trying to impart upon my children of like, okay, there may be things that happen in life that will feel like everything's being turned upside down. And how do we kind of like take a deep breath and still be able to, you know, keep going and plod forward, even if it doesn't feel great at the time.
And we've been through like 9/11, because after that the world shifted dramatically. I mean, we had an office in New York. I mean, I knew exactly how that felt. Knew how it felt during the pandemic. We think back, I'm old enough to remember when John F. Kennedy died. There are seminal moments that will shape a culture. They'll shape individuals, they'll shape kids. I do joke, my kids are older now, and this is the one line I've not heard from parents this year. I wish my kids still were young. No parent of older children is saying that right now. Not, there's no, oh, I wish mine was that age. Not at all, because you know that it's also going to mean sitting at the dining room table together. And it's just been a very, very different year. But I think that there's going to be something that comes out of this that's good as well, for people to have learned that you can't have everything, you know?
I think so. And I think that they're appreciating what it means to be with their friends a lot more. My first grader has gone back to school now, and he's been back for like, I think 2 weeks, the most glorious 2 weeks of my life. You know, I'm thankful to the school system that they've been able to institute a lot of, you know, really great protocols and distancing the kids so that they can feel safe, that everyone can feel as safe as possible in the classroom. And he's come back and he is so much happier. Kind of like he's breathed at home. He would eat like for hours straight. He just couldn't get any schoolwork done because he just constantly was like, I'm hungry, I'm hungry, you know? And it was kind of like a grouch eating. And he's gone to school. He's coming back with his lunch still in his container. So I'm like, you didn't eat anything. And he says, oh, I was too busy talking to my friends. And I'm like, oh, I'm so happy, you know?
The socialization that we've all like not had. You know, somebody said to me the other day, you know, like, have you gotten the vaccine? And I said, I just would like every teacher to get it first. I would like every teacher so they can go back, because that will help so many people go back to somewhat of a normal life. That's what we really need right now. We need people moving. Who can move the largest numbers of people back to their lives? And that's really what I'd like to be seeing right now. And even if kids only get from April to June at school, it will be so beneficial going back into September. Because if we wait till September, it's going to be a really long time for children to have sat at home.
It is. I mean, I can tell you, he's been back for 2 weeks, and we just feel it. We feel it. I see it in him. He's just like he's been reset, and I think it's really important. I hope we can have a nice summer where people can do a lot more stuff outdoors, you know, safely. I hope that these numbers don't come back up again. I'm seeing a dangerous little, kind of an unnerving little trend, but I think everyone hopefully will still stay super cautious. I've gotten dose one of my vaccine. I've told my parents who are vaccinated, thankfully, that using every single precaution, like don't let your guard down at all because we're not there yet.
No, we're not. And it's tough to get a vaccine appointment around here too. It's like no walk in the park. That's like a full-time job, is trying to get a vaccine appointment, which is just, we will not get into that. Like, this could, I think this all could have been handled a lot better, but you know, it's
A
a
lot
lot
better.
better. A lot better. It's like in New Jersey, they just opened it up to more people. And I'm like, more people? We haven't even taken care of 1A and 1B. You know, like, what are we doing? Can we just like accelerate that? Very interesting to watch. But it's also interesting to watch human behavior over the last year. And you saw it's not war, but it is an unsettling time, and how people handle unsettling times. And I think that when I was reading this book, what I was thinking is we're in a very not like, you know, major moment by what this child is going through, and how are people handling real crisis, like really, you know, what goes on. And you're thinking right now of people who have lost their businesses, lost, you know, large parts of their family or whatever. If it's there's there are different people are viewing things in different ways. And I think that when I was reading this book, that's what I was thinking about. She's got this window because she was there. And anybody who was outside that palace that day was not seeing things the same way she was, because she was there. They're not interpreting it, except this one man who tried to save her. And I think that when he comes back into her life later in the book, which I'm not giving any away because that was on the copy of the book, when he comes back, they have a shared experience. And I think that we go through things, and they'll be talking about the pandemic because we all had this, but what level of the shared experience? And I think that that's going to be an interesting thing to look at.
Yeah, I think we do that around any of those sentinel events that you were talking about, like where were you when, right? Is that guides the reaction. So you probably had the same reaction that I had. We were both in New York, we know what the air smelled like at that time. And it's I think comforting to know you were not alone in experiencing something. And it helps each of us process, that event when we know that other people had to process it as well and are on the other side of it, hopefully.
Yeah, I remember I was driving in that morning and one of the towers had been hit by a plane, but I thought it was like a Cessna. Like I didn't, and I was like, oh, that's downtown. I'm going to Midtown. Really didn't give it a thought. Second plane hit, thought, but was still, I had something I was supposed to be going into the city for. And I really, like, I guess my Catholic school guilt or something, thought I should still go to that meeting. Meanwhile, that meeting was never going to be happening. It was a big press conference. It was never going to be happening. And then the Pentagon got hit. And then, like, I'm just there, wait a second, I think I need to go home. Like, I think, like, something. And at the beginning, you're not really, like, really putting together what it is. You're like, oh, I still have an obligation. And there were a lot of people like me still heading towards the Lincoln Tunnel. We weren't going the other way. It was very interesting to see people's reactions.
Yeah, I think we were a bit, suspended in a state of disbelief until it could really sink in, what the gravity of the situation was and just, how big this was because we'd never seen anything like that here in our lifetimes.
Well, and it was interesting because my husband was sailing that day from Nantucket to the Hamptons. Okay. He was coming into the harbor. So they got up at 5:30 in the morning, like when the sun came up, and sailed down. They noticed there was nobody on the water when they pulled into the harbor. And it was such a beautiful day. It was that, we always talk about a severe clear that day. It was perfect blue. And he pulls into the harbor and no one is there. Like no one is on the docks, no one's any place. And one of the guys goes to throw off the garbage because they've been on this boat for a while. And he says something, I heard about 30,000 muerte. And he's like, what happened? So my husband calls me and he goes, what is going on? And I was like, well, where did you leave off? And he goes, what are you talking about? And he has none of that, this of the day that I have. So I was even thinking when I was reading this book is his perspective on the day is completely different from mine there. Like what I was having her, feelings of being in the palace were very different from somebody right outside the palace were very different. And I think that when you think about those kinds of ideas, and when I think about whenever 9/11 or the anniversary comes around, he has a totally different take. He has that phone call to me. And then he says, I'm going to come home and live in New Jersey. And he was like, I said, I don't know if you're going to be able to get here. Like they've locked everything down. And he goes, I am going to get home. And you heard a sigh of a person that you haven't heard before. And I think that these moments, like what we've been through the last year, moments like that, you hear who a person is inside of what they're going to do. And I think
I think
revealing.
those are really revealing moments, right? Sometimes revealing to ourselves and sometimes revealing to the people around us who, know us in a certain way, but it's not until that moment, right? Like it's not until you're married, but it's not until you have a kid that you realize, right? I mean, just different types of events that really, show us what we do at those, difficult, those pressure cooker moments, whether they're good pressure cooker moments or really horrific pressure cooker moments.
Yeah, and I remember pulling over to the side of the road and calling my staff and saying, just leave the office. And they're like, well, we have all these sites. I said, just leave. It doesn't matter. Like, do you understand that what mattered at, at 8:30 this morning does not matter anymore. Just leave. And to get people to change their whole heads about what's going on, and even during the pandemic, how many times going on tour is the most important thing for an author? Well, it's not anymore. Like, what are we going to do instead? And this is like, 13 months later in a lot of ways. And we're still sitting there trying to figure out what works and what doesn't. But
Yeah, exactly. I think we really struggle with resetting our priorities, and there's comfort in our routines as well, right? So, with what we did here at home was I said, okay, everyone is still gonna get up on time, because school had not really transitioned to virtual. It was just kind of a everybody's out, right? So I told my kids, okay, we're all getting up in the morning. We're gonna brush our teeth. We're gonna get dressed. We're gonna make our beds. Or at least I am. And we're just gonna have some kind of routine so that it doesn't feel so unsettling. Because when everything falls apart, then I think you get rocked into your core, right? So.
And that's what happened to Tara in her book. Her whole life got unrocked. And then, like, what are you going to do? And who do you trust? And who do you say can take care of you? And then there's a kind person, and you realize how kindness matters, and you realize things like that. So, well, I'm glad we got to talk, even though like neither of us had to leave the house. There was something nice about that. I mean, there was no early morning flight for you, right?
No, nothing for me. So this is all working well.
So it was absolutely lovely to talk to you again. I look forward to your next book. I think I've read everything that you've written, even the middle grade books. So this will be really lovely. So good luck on your project.
Appreciate it so much, Carol. It's always good to talk to you. Thank you so much for taking the time with this story too.
Great. And to our readers, look forward to seeing you next time on Book Reporter Talks Too. Keep listening for an audio excerpt from Sparks Like Stars, narrated by Mozan Marneau, coming up after the credits, courtesy of Harper Audio. Thank you for listening to Book Reporter Talks Too. Don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an episode. Support us by sharing on social media or by telling a friend about us. And we look forward to next time on Book Reporter Talks Too. Thanks to the producer of today's episode, Austin Rue. Thanks to our research assistant, Sam Johnson. And now, hear an audio excerpt from Sparks Like Stars, courtesy of Harper Audio.
A string of vehicles pulled into the circular palace driveway, disappearing one by one as their engines and headlights cut off. I watched silhouettes emerge and approach the main entrance of the palace. Nilab, they're here, I whispered. How many cars? 15, maybe? It's too dark out, hard to tell. We're going to have to go soon, Nilab warned. Mother must have seen the cars approach, too. Her voice echoed from down the hall. The palace buzzed as it did on those special occasions when its grandest rooms filled with the most important guests. Sitara, where are you? I could not hide my disappointment. I looked at Nilab, sitting on the floor with her knees drawn to her chest. The lamplight cast a yellow glow on her cheeks. It's a weekend, I groaned. They want all the little children in bed when they open that box downstairs, Nilab said, repeating what her mother had told her. You might as well go to her before she finds you. But surrender had never been my style. What about you? I bet your mother is looking for you too. Nilab shook her head. No way. I'm a young woman now. The rules have changed. This amused me. You're barely a full year older than me, and you'd have to wear heels to look me in the eye. Go ahead and tease, but if I wanted to, I could throw on one of my dresses and join them downstairs and no one would say a thing, Nilab declared, arms folded across her chest. I loved her too much to point out to her how flat it still was. Is Nilab with you? Mother asked, as if she'd forgotten that Nilab and I had been inseparable since I had learned to walk. It's past time for her to turn in too. Nilab avoided my eyes then. She hated to be wrong almost as much as I relished being right. My best friend and I had ducked into the presidential library so I could thumb through a text I'd discovered last week. The Book of Fixed Stars was written 1,000 years ago by an astronomer named Al-Sufi. Like me, he'd been fascinated by constellations, stories written in a pen of light. I'd drawn the velvet curtain so I could match the constellations on the page with the stars of the night sky. One by one, I found them and marveled that time hadn't stolen a single flickering gem. I'm here, Madar, I called out, glancing at the pages splayed before me. Al-Sufi had sketched the serpentine tail of Draco, a fork-tongued dragon circling Ursa Minor. I had read, but had yet to confirm through observation, that it was visible all year long from Kabul's latitude. Our months were named after constellations, and soon it would be the month of Sar, or Taurus. I drew lines between stars and saw the bull's sword-like horns piercing the sky. The hairs on the back of my neck prickled to picture the giant beast leaping down from the heavens and galloping on this land. Mother poked her head between the French doors of the library. There you are. It's getting late, girls, she chided gently. Sitara, I need you to stay with your brother so I can go downstairs. They're serving dinner soon, and it won't look right if I'm not at your father's side. But Kaka Daoud told us we could. The man I called Uncle Daoud was Nilab's grandfather. For the past 5 years, he also happened to be the president of Afghanistan, and he granted us almost unlimited access to the presidential library with its irresistible floor-to-ceiling bookshelves. In truth, there was no blood relation between my father and President Dawood, but our families were so close that Nilab and I had been raised as cousins. My father was the president's most trusted advisor. We often stayed overnight in the palace, especially when the president hosted evening functions. Nilab and I would find a corner of the palace to hide in on those nights and talk until we fell asleep, the sound of music streaming up from the garden. We exchanged secrets that bound us together more profoundly than blood would have. Nilab knew of the time I had taken one of my mother's pearl rings and traded it with a classmate for a doll with eyelids that opened and closed. And only I knew that General Jamshid's pimply-faced son had penned a love note to Nilab. Song lyrics on a sheet of lined notebook paper. Over the years, Nilab, her brother Rostam, and I had explored every square foot of Arg, the name for the presidential palace. We would walk the perimeter, summoning moments from history and inserting ourselves into them. While Nilab and I fired imaginary bullets from our fingertips, Rustam pretended to be an invader trespassing the deep trench that was now filled in with green grass. We conjured the silky voices of the king's concubines in the building that was once a harem, then popped into the structure once used for army barracks, and marched high-kneed and saluting. Rostam read stories of Genghis Khan's conquests in this land while we sat in a vacant turret, our eyes tracing the sawtooth mountains that guarded Kabul like palace walls. If we could have moved through time, we would have visited every decade of Arg's history to see how accurate we'd been in reenacting the signing of treaties, the betrayal of trusts, the never-ending fight for our country's independence from foreign invasion.